Okay, let's unpack this. Welcome to the deep dive, where we are cutting straight through the complexity of risk. We're often told risk is just, a statistical problem. But our sources today, specifically research on global volatility by Michelle Angry-Boucher, suggest it's much, much deeper than that.
It really is. Risk often feels like this four-letter word, something terrifying and unavoidable. But the fundamental idea here, and it goes way back to the early Italian risicere, is that risk means to dare.
To dare. So it's not a fate, it's a choice.
It is absolutely a choice.
And to choose wisely, you need information.
Oh, yeah.
Perfect intelligence, really. So our mission today is to reframe that core challenge. Risk equals uncertainty, which really just means an information deficit.
Right.
Our goal is to break down what that deficit actually looks like, how we can classify the dangers we face, and, well, how we dare to move forward when we don't have all the answers.
That information deficit is the entire battleground. And we're moving beyond just the usual financial models here. We're looking at frameworks used by major global institutions to assess volatility.
And what's fascinating is how these sources classify crises. They actually separate the truly unpredictable events from the ones we just refuse to see coming.
That's the core of it, the unavoidable versus the unheeded.
It's a huge distinction, isn't it? And it's crucial for anyone trying to anticipate what's next. So the material lays out two very distinct types of crises.
It does. Let's start with type one. This is your classic brutal shock. The timing is absolutely impossible to anticipate.
It just happens.
It just happens, and it forces this immediate, drastic adjustment from everyone.
The truly random, terrible surprises that nobody could put a date on.
Exactly. The sources point to things like the 1973 OPEC oil crisis, the 2004 Asian tsunami, or the 2011 Fukushima disaster. These are sudden jolts to the system. The date of impact was unknowable beforehand.
Okay, so that's type one, but then there's type two, and this one is, frankly, a lot more sobering.
It is. A type two crisis also emerges brutally, and it might even feel unprecedented, but, and this is the key, it's classified as probable. It should have been expected.
This is where accountability comes in.
Absolutely. The main examples here are the 2008 financial crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic. And for COVID, the source just lists the warnings one after another.
Like what?
A CIA report from 2005, Bill Gates' TED Talk in 2015. The World Bank set up a specific pandemic planning facility in 2016, even a U.S. government planning exercise in 2019 called Crimson Contagion. The warnings were there.
But wait, if that many warnings existed, why did everyone, governments, markets treat it like a complete type one, totally random event? Was the failure in the prediction or something else?
The source suggests the failure was one of heeding, not forecasting. It was an anticipated risk that was, institutionally ignored.
Which brings us to the foundation of the problem, this academic difference between risk and uncertainty.
Right. We have to go back to Frank Knight in 1921.
Was his big idea? What was the core difference for him?
Well, Knight established that risk is when you have outcomes that are unknown, but you can assign a clear probability to them. You know all the possible outcomes. Uncertainty, on the other hand, comes from a pure deficit of information. You don't even know what the potential results are, so it just feels random.
So if I'm rolling a standard die, that's risk. I know the
Yeah.
six possibilities, I know the odds, but
Exactly.
if I'm betting on some brand new technology that might not even be physically possible, that's pure uncertainty.
Precisely. Then you fast forward to Harry Markowitz in 1959, and he's the one who formalized how we manage that known risk. He defined risk as the probability of loss, measured by historical volatility.
Things like standard deviation or beta.
Yes. And for anyone who doesn't run an equity fund, can we just quickly unpack why historical volatility doesn't capture something like, say, a political revolution?
Sure. It's because it's backward-looking. Standard deviation assumes tomorrow's risks will look a lot like yesterday's. It's great at measuring known
And
unknowns.
it completely fails to capture a sudden break, a revolution which just fundamentally changes all the rules of the economy.
And this is exactly what J.M. Keynes was warning about, also way back in 1921. He said, "Never to expect the future to be a simple projection of the past."
He highlighted the irrational, powerful role of animal spirits that drive herd behavior and, huge volatility in markets.
So Markowitz measured the knowns, but Keynes was warning us about the human factor, the behavioral unpredictability.
Yes. And that takes us neatly into the spectrum of uncertainty itself. How do we actually map this idea of an information deficit?
So we move from what the source calls weak uncertainty,
which is just measurable risk. Everyone has the same data. Everyone basically agrees on the odds. It's quantifiable, manageable.
To strong uncertainty. And this is where the truly paralyzing risks live. The sources break this down into three different types, and we should probably get clear on these.
They're subtle, but the distinction is vital. First, you have substantive uncertainty. This is just a simple lack of all the necessary information.
So it's like having half the pieces to a jigsaw puzzle. You can see the picture, but you don't have the data to finish it.
That's a great way to put it. Then the second type is fundamental uncertainty. This one's deeper.
Okay.
Here, the list of possible events is not knowable beforehand because the future literally has yet to be created.
This is like trying to guess the rules of a game that hasn't even been invented yet.
Exactly. This is what Keynes was most concerned about. And the third type is procedural uncertainty.
And what's that?
Here, people might have all the information, all the puzzle pieces, but they lack a complete understanding of the structure of the problem itself.
So they don't know what the final picture is supposed to look like or even how the pieces connect.
Right. And then you have to throw two more concepts into that mix.
Ambiguity and complexity.
Exactly. Ambiguity is when you have plenty of information, but it's all conflicting. You have competing expert opinions, or you just don't understand the cause and effect.
And complexity.
Complexity is exposure to events with just massive, wide-ranging ramifications, huge spillover effects.
Okay, to make this tangible, the source gives us a country risk matrix example. We can see how these definitions actually apply in the real world.
We can. A standard economic event like exchange rate depreciation, that's firmly under weak, measurable uncertainty. It's modeled every day.
But something like a revolution, strikes, or a coup d'etat?
That's a structural, strong uncertainty risk. And the coronavirus event is categorized specifically under complexity.
Because of the sheer volume of its spillover effects, it hit health, travel, finance, supply chains, everything at once.
All at once.
So if these concepts, especially strong uncertainty, are so layered and nebulous, how do we even begin to measure them? It's fascinating because the sources point to three main ways we try to quantify this information deficit.
And we have to try because high uncertainty just freezes an economy. It stops investment, halts consumption, tanks markets, and can spark a recession.
So what are the three measurement tools?
First, there are text-based measures. This is literally measuring anxiety by how much ink is spilled over it.
What do you mean?
Researchers analyze thousands of newspaper articles for terms related to economics, policy, uncertainty. The Economic Policy Uncertainty Index, the EPU, is a prime example.
And that index?
It surged after the 2008 crisis and then went off the charts during the 2020 pandemic. It's a surprisingly effective proxy for market anxiety.
So we're literally quantifying the media's nervousness.
Pretty much. The second approach is financial market-based measures. The most famous one here is the VIX.
The fear index.
A fear index. The Chicago Board Options Exchange Volatility Index. It calculates the implied volatility of S&P 500 options.
So it's a measure of how much investors are willing to pay to protect themselves from future price swings.
Exactly. And the third measure is more direct.
Survey-based.
Right. Survey-based measures, like the U.S. Survey of Business Uncertainty. These tools just ask business leaders directly about their expectations.
And they must have spiked during the pandemic.
They went vertical. It shows you just how fast business confidence can absolutely crater when a threat is perceived.
Okay, now let's talk about those really rare but hugely consequential events. Extreme risk or fat tails. Why does the standard bell curve, the normal distribution, fail us here?
The bell curve is comforting, but it assumes extreme events are almost impossible. It expects everything to cluster around the average.
But for the events that cause system collapse, that assumption just down, it breaks down.
Huh.
In a bell curve world, almost everyone is average height, average wealth.
And a fat tail is when you suddenly pull a 7-foot-tall NBA player and a billionaire into your sample and your average becomes meaningless.
Exactly. The source uses a great example. If you randomly pick two people and their combined income is $40 million, that outcome is so far outside the Gaussian comfort zone. These are heavy-tailed events.
Meaning extreme outcomes happen much more frequently than the standard models would ever predict.
And this brings us to this crucial distinction between black swans and dragon kings. This really shifts the entire conversation around accountability, doesn't it?
It does. Nassim Taleb, of course, popularized the Black Swan, an event that seems to come from nowhere, grows to an extreme size, and is considered inherently unpredictable beforehand.
You can only explain it in hindsight.
Exactly. But the Dragon King model, developed by Didier Sornet, offers this really provocative counterargument.
How does a Dragon King differ, and why does it bring accountability back into the picture?
A Dragon King is also huge in impact. A massive financial collapse, a war. But it's born from unique nonlinear origins, often driven by intense herd instinct and, this is the key, super exponential acceleration right before it collapses.
So black swans come out of nowhere, but dragon kings are screaming, accelerating towards a peak that we are actively ignoring.
Precisely. Because of this super exponential acceleration where the problem grows faster than exponentially, driven by positive feedback loops like a speculative mania, their occurrences can be diagnosed ex ante.
Beforehand.
Beforehand. The math shows a clear path toward the breaking point. So if a Dragon King hits, it means institutions failed to heed the observable acceleration.
That is a staggering implication. I mean, if you look at the late stages of the 2008 housing bubble, that visible acceleration, that was the Dragon King signal we missed.
It was. And it fundamentally shifts the job of risk management from impossible prediction to accountable recognition.
So what does all this mean for making actual practical decisions?
Yeah.
How do institutions take all this theory and apply it to something concrete, like assessing a country's risk profile?
Well, a good assessment has to synthesize a whole range of indicators. You're combining liquidity indicators like inflation, foreign reserves, with solvency and structural indicators like debt levels and productivity. It's a holistic picture.
The source gives us a great comparison between Italy and Spain using projected 2025 data. And it's never a simple A is better than B assessment, is it?
Far from it. On paper, Spain shows better structural performance. Its projected debt to GDP is about 103% versus Italy's much higher, 135%.
And Spain also has a much better doing business rank.
Much better. 30th out of 190 countries versus Italy's 58th.
Now, why does that 32-point difference in debt to GDP matter so much to an investor?
It translates directly into the market's perception of solvency. A higher debt ratio means less fiscal space to maneuver, higher borrowing costs, and more vulnerability to shocks.
But Italy performs slightly better on GDP per capita.
And surprisingly lower unemployment, at 6% versus 10.5% in Spain. But that's the point. It shows that current economic activity doesn't always cancel out long-term structural risks.
And we see that complex tapestry of factors even more clearly when comparing countries in different stages of development, like the case study for North Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria.
Exactly. This is where things like the Human Development Index and corruption rankings become just as important as debt levels. Morocco looks strong in some non-financial areas.
It's like the lowest multidimensional poverty index.
And the best doing business rank of the three, at 53rd.
But then you have Tunisia, with a very poor doing business rank, way down at 157. That's a huge red flag for foreign investment.
A massive one. Meanwhile, Algeria shows a high gender inequality index, which points to significant long-term structural weakness in how it uses its human capital. The lesson is that robust risk assessment means synthesizing everything.
Politics, corruption, economic fundamentals, and societal resilience.
All of it.
This has been a true deep dive into the architecture of risk. To wrap up, I think the core takeaways are: crises aren't all the same, uncertainty is a complex spectrum, and crucially, extreme risks might be far more predictable than we assume.
And that fundamentally changes the job of a risk manager.
Absolutely.
The sources make it crystal clear. The ultimate risk mitigation strategy is transforming raw information into actionable knowledge, economic intelligence. Reliable, updated information is the foundation for any robust analysis. It's the foundation for daring to succeed.
That's a great note to end on. And since the sources suggest that Dragon Kings, those extreme events like financial collapses or wars, might be diagnosable beforehand because of that super exponential acceleration, here's a provocative thought for you to mull over. What common event or structural weakness today do you think is currently exhibiting Dragon King characteristics, accelerating toward a point of accountability and collapse that we are currently choosing to ignore?